via safe exit routes that avoided jumpers and debris, to leave the complex urgently but calmly. It is impossible to measure how many more civilians would have died but for the determination of many members of the FDNY, PAPD, and NYPD to continue assisting civilians after the South Tower collapsed. It is impossible to measure the calming influence that ascending firefighters had on descending civilians, or whether but for the firefighters' presence, the poor behavior of a very few civilians could have caused a dangerous and panicked mob flight. But the positive impact of the first responders on the evacuation came at a tremendous cost of first responder lives lost. Civilian and private sector challenges. The first responders on 9/11, as in most catastrophes, were private sector civilians. Because 85% of our nation's critical infrastructure is controlled not by government but by the private sector civilians are likely to be the first responders in any future catastrophes. For that reason, we have assessed the state of private sector and civilian preparedness in order to formulate recommendations to address this critical need. Our recommendations grow out of the experience of the civilians at the World Trade Center on 9/11. Lack of protocol for rooftop rescues. Civilians at or above the impact zone in the North Tower had the smallest hope of survival. Once the plane struck, they were prevented from descending because of damage to or impassable conditions in the building's three stairwells. The only hope for those on the upper floors of the North Tower would have been a swift and extensive air rescue. Several factors made this impossible. Doors leading to the roof were kept locked for security reasons, and damage to software in the security command station prevented a lock release order from taking effect. Even if the doors had not been locked, structural and radiation hazards made the rooftops unsuitable staging areas for a large number of civilians. And even if conditions permitted general helicopter evacuations, which was not the case, only several people could be lifted at a time. The WTC lacked any plan for evacuation of civilians on upper floors of the WTC in the event that all stairwells were impassable below. Lack of comprehensive evacuation of South Tower immediately after the North Tower impact. No decision has been criticized more than the decision of building personnel not to evacuate the South Tower immediately after the North Tower was hit. A firm and prompt evacuation order would likely have led many to safety. Even a strict advisory announcement would not have dissuaded those who decided for themselves to evacuate. The advice to stay in place was understandable, however, when considered in its context. At that moment, no one appears to have thought a second plane could hit the South Tower. The evacuation of thousands of people was seen as inherently dangerous. Additionally, conditions were hazardous in some areas outside the towers. Less understandable, in our view, is the instruction given to some civilians who had reached the lobby to return to their offices. They could have been held in the lobby or perhaps directed through the underground concourse. Despite the initial advice given over its public address system, the South Tower was ordered to be evacuated by the FDNY and PAPD within 12 minutes of the North Tower's being hit. If not for a second unanticipated attack, the evacuation presumably would have proceeded. Impact of fire safety plan and fire drills on evacuation. Once the South Tower was hit, civilians on upper floors wasted time ascending the stairs instead of searching for a clear path down when stairwell A was at least initially passable. Although rooftop rescues had not been conclusively ruled out, civilians were not informed in fire drills that roof doors were locked, that rooftop areas were hazardous, and that no helicopter evacuation plan existed. In both towers, civilians who were able to reach the stairs and descend were also stymied by the deviations in the stairways and by smoke doors. This confusion delayed the evacuation of some and may have obstructed that of others. The Port Authority has acknowledged that in the future, tenants should be made aware of what conditions they will encounter during descent. Impact of 911 calls on evacuation. The NYPD's 911 operators and FDNY dispatch were not adequately integrated into the emergency response. In several ways, the 911 system was not ready to cope with a major disaster. These operators and dispatchers were one of the only sources of information for individuals at and above the impact zone of the towers. The FDNY ordered both towers fully evacuated at 8:57, but this guidance was not conveyed to 911 operators and FDNY dispatchers, who for the next hour often continued to advise civilians not to self-evacuate, regardless of whether they were above or below the impact zones. Nor were 911 operators or FDNY dispatchers advised that rooftop rescues had been ruled out. This failure may have been harmful to civilians on the upper floors of the South Tower who called 911 and were not told that their only evacuation hope was to attempt to descend, not to ascend. In planning for future disasters, it is important to integrate those taking 911 calls into the emergency response team and to involve them in providing up-to-date information and assistance to the public. Preparedness of individual civilians. One clear lesson of September 11th is that individual civilians need to take responsibility for maximizing the probability that they will survive should disaster strike. Clearly, many building occupants in the World Trade Center did not take preparedness seriously. Individuals should know the exact location of every stairwell in their workplace. In addition, they should have access at all times to flashlights, which were deemed invaluable by some civilians who managed to evacuate the WTC on September 11th. Challenges experienced by first responders. The challenge of incident command. As noted above, in July 2001, Mayor Giuliani updated a directive titled Direction and Control of Emergencies in the City of New York. The directive designated four different types of emergencies an appropriate agency as incident commander. It would be responsible for the management of the city's response to the emergency. The directive also provided that where incidents are so multifaceted that no one agency immediately stands out as the incident commander, OEM will assign the role of incident commander to an agency as the situation demands. To some degree, the mayor's directive for incident command was followed on 9/11. It was clear that the lead response agency was the FDNY, and that the other responding local, federal, bi-state, and state agencies acted in a supporting role. There was a tacit understanding that FDNY personnel would have primary responsibility for evacuating civilians who were above the ground floors of the Twin Towers, while NYPD and PAPD personnel would be in charge of evacuating civilians from the WTC complex once they reached ground level. The NYPD also greatly assisted responding FDNY units by clearing emergency lanes to the WTC. In addition, coordination occurred at high levels of command. For example, the mayor and police commissioner consulted with the chief of the department of the FDNY at approximately 9:20. There were other instances of coordination at operational levels, and information was shared on an ad hoc basis. For example, an NYPD ESU team passed the news of their evacuation order to firefighters in the North Tower. It is also clear, however, that the response operations lacked the kind of integrated communications and unified command contemplated in the directive. These problems existed both within and among individual responding agencies. Command and control within the first responder agencies. For a unified incident management system to succeed, each respondent must have command and control of its own units and adequate internal communications. This was not always the case at the WTC on 9/11. Understandably lacking experience in responding to events of the magnitude of the World Trade Center attacks, the FDNY as an institution proved incapable of coordinating the number of units dispatched to different points within the 16-acre complex. As a result, numerous units were congregating in the undamaged Marriott Hotel and at the overall command post on West Street by 9:30, while chiefs in charge of the South Tower still were in desperate need of units. With better understanding of the resources already available, the additional units might not have been dispatched to the South Tower at 9:37. The task of accounting for and coordinating the units was rendered difficult, if not impossible, by internal communications breakdowns resulting from the limited capabilities of radios in the high-rise environment of the WTC and from confusion over which personnel were assigned to which frequency. Furthermore, when the South Tower collapsed, the overall FDNY command post ceased to operate, which compromised the FDNY's ability to understand the situation. An FDNY Marine unit's immediate radio communication to FDNY dispatch that the South Tower had fully collapsed was not conveyed to chiefs at the scene. The FDNY's inability to coordinate and account for the different radio channels that would be used in an emergency of this scale contributed to the early lack of units in the South Tower, whose lobby chief initially could not communicate with anyone outside that tower. Though almost no one at 9:50 a.m. on September 11th was contemplating an imminent total collapse of the Twin Towers, many first responders and civilians were contemplating the possibility of imminent additional terrorist attacks throughout New York City. Had any such attacks occurred, the FDNY's response would have been severely compromised by the concentration of so many of its off-duty personnel, particularly its elite personnel, at the WTC. The Port Authority's response was hampered by the lack of both standard operating procedures and radios capable of enabling multiple commands to respond in unified fashion to an incident at the WTC. Many officers reporting from the tunnel and airport commands could not hear instructions being issued over the WTC command frequency. In addition, command and control was complicated by senior Port Authority police officers becoming directly involved in frontline rescue operations. The NYPD experienced comparatively few internal command and control and communications issues. Because the department has a history of mobilizing thousands of officers for major events requiring crowd control, its technical radio capability and major incident protocols were more easily adapted to an incident of the magnitude of 9/11. In addition, its mission that day lay largely outside the towers themselves. Although there were ESU teams and a few individual police officers climbing in the towers, the vast majority of NYPD personnel were staged outside, assisting with crowd control and evacuation and securing other sites in the city. The NYPD ESU division had firm command and control over its units, in part because there were so few of them in comparison to the number of FDNY companies, and all reported to the same ESU command post. It is unclear, however, whether non-ESU NYPD officers operating on the ground floors and in a few cases on upper floors of the WTC were as well coordinated. Significant shortcomings within the FDNY's command and control capabilities were painfully exposed on September 11th. To its great credit, the department has made a substantial effort in the past 3 years to address these. While significant problems in the command and control of the PAPD also were exposed on September 11th, it is less clear that the Port Authority has adopted new training exercises or major incident protocols to address these shortcomings. Lack of coordination among first responder agencies. Any attempt to establish a unified command on 9/11 would have been further frustrated by the lack of communication and coordination among responding agencies. Certainly, the FDNY was not responsible for the management of the city's response to the emergency, as the mayor's directive would have required. The command posts were in different locations, and OEM headquarters, which could have served as a focal point for information sharing, did not play an integrating role in ensuring that information was shared among agencies on 9/11, even prior to its evacuation. There was a lack of comprehensive coordination between FDNY, NYPD, and PAPD personnel climbing above the ground floors in the Twin Towers. Information that was critical to informed decision-making was not shared among agencies. FDNY chiefs in leadership roles that morning have told us that their decision-making capability was hampered by a lack of information from NYPD Aviation. At 9:51 a.m., a helicopter pilot cautioned that large pieces of the South Tower appeared to be about to fall and could pose a danger to those below. Immediately after the tower's collapse, a helicopter pilot radioed that news. This transmission was followed by communications at 10:08, 10:15, and 10:22 that called into question the condition of the North Tower. The FDNY chiefs would have benefited greatly had they been able to communicate with personnel in a helicopter. The consequence of the lack of real-time intelligence from NYPD Aviation should not be overstated. Contrary to a widely held misperception, no NYPD helicopter predicted the fall of either tower before the South Tower collapsed, and no NYPD personnel began to evacuate the WTC complex prior to that time. Furthermore, the FDNY as an institution was in possession of the knowledge that the South Tower had collapsed as early as the NYPD, as its fall had been immediately reported by an FDNY boat on a dispatch channel. Because of internal breakdowns within the department, however, this information was not disseminated to FDNY personnel on the scene. The FDNY, PAPD, and NYPD did not coordinate their units that were searching the WTC complex for civilians. In many cases, redundant searches of specific floors and areas were conducted. It is unclear whether fewer first responders in the aggregate would have been in the Twin Towers if there had been an integrated response, or what impact, if any, redundant searches had on the total number of first responder fatalities. Whether the lack of coordination between the FDNY and NYPD on September 11th had a catastrophic effect has been the subject of controversy. We believe that there are too many variables for us to responsibly quantify those consequences. It is clear that the lack of coordination did not affect adversely the evacuation of civilians. It is equally clear, however, that the incident command system did not function to integrate awareness among agencies or to facilitate interagency response. If New York and other major cities are to be prepared for future terrorist attacks, different first responder agencies within each city must be fully coordinated, just as different branches of the U.S. military are. Coordination entails a unified command that comprehensively deploys all dispatched police, fire, and other first responder resources. In May 2004, New York City adopted an emergency response plan that expressly contemplates two or more agencies jointly being lead agency when responding to a terrorist attack, but does not mandate a comprehensive and unified incident command that can deploy and monitor all first responder resources from one overall command post. In our judgment, this falls short of an optimal response plan, which requires clear command and control, common training, and the trust that such training creates. The experience of the military suggests that integrated into such a coordinated response should be a unified field intelligence unit, which should receive and combine information from all first responders, including 911 operators. Such a field intelligence unit could be valuable in large and complex incidents. Radio communication challenges, the effectiveness and urgency of evacuation instructions. As discussed above, the location of the NYPD ESU command post was crucial in making possible an urgent evacuation order explaining the South Tower's full collapse. Firefighters most certainly would have benefited from that information. A separate matter is the varied success at conveying evacuation instructions to personnel in the North Tower after the South Tower's collapse. The success of NYPD ESU instruction is attributable to a combination of 1, the strength of the radios, 2, the relatively small numbers of individuals using them, and 3, use of the correct channel by all. The same three factors worked against successful communication among FDNY personnel. First, the radio's effectiveness was drastically reduced in the high-rise environment. Second, Tactical Channel 1 was simply overwhelmed by the number of units attempting to communicate on it at 10 o'clock. Third, some firefighters were on the wrong channel or simply lacked radios altogether. It is impossible to know what difference it made that units in the North Tower were not using the repeater channel after 10 o'clock. While the repeater channel was at least partially operational before the South Tower collapsed, we do not know whether it continued to be operational after 9:59. Even without the repeater channel, at least 24 of the at most 32 companies who were dispatched to and actually in the North Tower received the evacuation instruction, either via radio or directly from other first responders. Nevertheless, many of these firefighters died either because they delayed their evacuation to assist civilians, attempted to regroup their units, lacked urgency, or some combination of these factors. In addition, many other firefighters not dispatched to the North Tower also died in its collapse. Some had their radios on the wrong channel. Others were off duty and lacked radios. In view of these considerations, we conclude that the technical failure of FDNY radios, while a contributing factor, was not the primary cause of many firefighter fatalities in the North Tower. The FDNY has worked hard in the past several years to address its radio deficiencies. To improve radio capability in high-rises, the FDNY has internally developed a post radio that is small enough for a battalion chief to carry to the upper floors and that greatly repeats and enhances radio signal strength. The story with respect to Port Authority police officers in the North Tower is less complicated. Most of them lacked access to the radio channel on which the Port Authority police evacuation order was given. Since September 11th, the Port Authority has worked hard to integrate the radio systems of their different commands. The lesson of 9/11 for civilians and first responders can be stated simply. In the new age of terror, they, we, are the primary targets. The losses America suffered that day demonstrated both the gravity of the terrorist threat and the commensurate need to prepare ourselves to meet it. The first responders of today live in a world transformed by the attacks on 9/11. Because no one believes that every conceivable form of attack can be prevented, civilians and first responders will again find themselves on the front lines. We must plan for that eventuality. A rededication to preparedness is perhaps the best way to honor the memories of those we lost that day.
Chapter 10, Wartime. After the attacks had occurred, while crisis managers were still sorting out a number of unnerving false alarms, Air Force One flew to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. One of these alarms was of a reported threat against Air Force One itself, a threat eventually run down to a misunderstood communication in the hectic White House Situation Room that morning. While the plan at the elementary school had been to return to Washington by the time Air Force One was airborne at 9:55 a.m., the Secret Service, the President's advisors, and Vice President Cheney were strongly advising against it. President Bush reluctantly acceded to this advice, and at about 10:10, Air Force One changed course and began heading due west. The immediate objective was to find a safe location, not too far away, where the President could land and speak to the American people. The Secret Service was also interested in refueling the aircraft and paring down the size of the traveling party. The President's military aide and Air Force officer quickly searched the options and sometime around 10:20 identified Barksdale Air Force Base as an appropriate interim destination. When Air Force One landed at Barksdale at about 11:45, personnel from the local Secret Service office were still en route to the airfield. The motorcade consisted of a military police lead vehicle and a van. The proposed briefing theater had no phones or electrical outlets. Staff scrambled to prepare another room for the President's remarks while the lead Secret Service agent reviewed the security situation with superiors in Washington. The President completed his statement, which for security reasons was taped and not broadcast live, and the traveling party returned to Air Force One. The next destination was discussed. Once again, the Secret Service recommended against returning to Washington, and the Vice President agreed. Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska was chosen because of its elaborate command and control facilities and because it could accommodate overnight lodging for 50 persons. The Secret Service wanted a place where the President could spend several days if necessary. Air Force One arrived at Offutt at 2:50 p.m., at about 3:15, President Bush met with his principal advisors through a secure video teleconference. Rice said President Bush began the meeting with the words, "We're at war," and the Director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, said the agency was still assessing who was responsible, but the early signs all pointed to Al-Qaeda. That evening, the Deputies Committee returned to the pending presidential directive they had labored over during the summer. The Secretary of Defense directed the nation's armed forces to Defense Condition 3, an increased state of military readiness. For the first time in history, all non-emergency civilian aircraft in the United States were grounded, stranding tens of thousands of passengers across the country. Contingency plans for the continuity of government and the evacuation of leaders had been implemented. The Pentagon had been struck. The White House or the Capitol had narrowly escaped direct attack. Extraordinary security precautions were put in place at the nation's borders and ports. In the late afternoon, the President overruled his aide's continuing reluctance to have him return to Washington and ordered Air Force One back to Andrews Air Force Base. He was flown by helicopter back to the White House, passing over the still smoldering Pentagon. At 8:30 that evening, President Bush addressed the nation from the White House. After emphasizing that the first priority was to help the injured and protect against any further attacks, he said, "We will make no distinction between the terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them." He quoted Psalm 23, "Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, no American," he said, "will ever forget this day." Following his speech, President Bush met again with his National Security Council, NSC, expanded to include Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta and Joseph Albaugh, the director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Secretary of State Colin Powell, who had returned from Peru after hearing of the attacks, joined the discussion. They reviewed the day's events. Section 10.1, Immediate Responses at Home. As the urgent domestic issues accumulated, White House Deputy Chief of Staff Joshua Bolton chaired a temporary domestic consequences group. The agenda in those first days is worth noting partly as a checklist for future crisis planners. It began with problems of how to help victims and stanch the flowing losses to the U.S. economy, such as organizing federal emergency assistance. One question was what kind of public health advice to give about the air quality in Lower Manhattan in the vicinity of the fallen buildings. Compensating victims. They evaluated legislative options, eventually setting up a federal compensation fund and defining the powers of a special master to run it. Determining federal assistance. On September 13th, President Bush promised to provide $20 billion for New York City, in addition to the $20 billion his budget director had already guessed might be needed for the country as a whole. Restoring civil aviation. On the morning of September 13th, the national airspace reopened for use by airports that met newly improvised security standards. Reopening the financial markets. After extraordinary emergency efforts involving the White House, the Treasury Department, and the Securities and Exchange Commission, aided by unprecedented cooperation among the usually competitive firms of the financial industry, the markets reopened on Monday, September 17th. Deciding when and how to return border and port security to more normal operations. Evaluating legislative proposals to bail out the airline industry and cap its liability. The very process of reviewing these issues underscored the absence of an effective government organization dedicated to assessing vulnerabilities and handling problems of protection and preparedness. Though a number of agencies had some part of the task, none had security as its primary mission. By September 14th, Vice President Cheney had decided to recommend, at least as a first step, a new White House entity to coordinate all the relative agencies rather than tackle the challenge of combining them in a new department. This new White House entity would be a Homeland Security Advisor and Homeland Security Council, paralleling the National Security Council system. Vice President Cheney reviewed the proposal with President Bush and other advisors. President Bush announced the new post and its first occupant, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge, in his address to a joint session of Congress on September 20th. Beginning on September 11th, Immigration and Naturalization Service agents working in cooperation with the FBI began arresting individuals for immigration violations whom they encountered while following up leads in the FBI's investigation of the 9/11 attacks. Eventually, 768 aliens were arrested as special interest detainees. Some, such as Zacharias Moussaoui, were actually in INS custody before 9/11. Most were arrested after. Attorney General John Ashcroft told us that he saw his job in directing this effort as risk minimization, both to find out who had committed the attacks and to prevent a subsequent attack. Ashcroft ordered all special interest immigration hearings closed to the public, family members, and press, directed government attorneys to seek denial of bond until such time as they were cleared of terrorist connections by the FBI and other agencies, and ordered the identity of the detainees kept secret. INS attorneys charged with prosecuting the immigration violations had trouble getting information about the detainees and any terrorist connections. In the chaos after the attacks, it was very difficult to reach law enforcement officials who were following up on other leads. The clearance process approved by the Justice Department was time-consuming, lasting an average of about 80 days. We have assessed this effort to detain aliens of special interest. The detainees were lawfully held on immigration charges. Records indicate that 531 were deported, 162 were released on bond, 24 received some kind of immigration benefits, 12 have their proceedings terminated, and 8, one of whom was Moussaoui, were remanded to the custody of the U.S. Marshals Service. The Inspector General of the Justice Department found significant problems in the way the 9/11 detainees were treated. In response to a request about the counterterrorism benefits of the 9/11 detainee program, the Justice Department cited 6 individuals on the special interest detainee list, noting that 2, including Mousawi, were linked directly to a terrorist organization and that it had obtained new leads helpful to the investigation of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. A senior al-Qaeda detainee has stated that U.S. government efforts after the 9/11 attacks to monitor the American homeland, including review of Muslims' immigration files and deportation of non-permanent residents, forced al-Qaeda to operate less freely in the United States. The government's ability to collect intelligence inside the United States and the sharing of such information between the intelligence and law enforcement communities was not a priority before 9/11. Guidelines on the subject issued in August 2001 by Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson essentially recapitulated prior guidance. However, the attacks of 9/11 changed everything. Less than 1 week after September 11th, an early version of what was to become the Patriot Act, officially the USA Patriot Act, began to take shape. A central provision of the proposal was the removal of the wall on information sharing between the intelligence and law enforcement communities. Ashcroft told us he was determined to make every conceivable action within the limits of the Constitution to identify potential terrorists and deter additional attacks. The administration developed a proposal that eventually passed both houses of Congress by large majorities and was signed into law on October 26th. Flights of Saudi nationals leaving the United States. 3 questions have arisen with respect to the departure of Saudi nationals from the United States in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. 1. Did any flights of Saudi nationals take place before national airspace reopened on September 13, 2001? 2. Was there any political intervention to facilitate the departure of Saudi nationals? 3. Did the FBI screen Saudi nationals thoroughly before their departure? First, we found no evidence that any flights of Saudi nationals, domestic or international, took place before the reopening of national airspace on the morning of September 13, 2001. To the contrary, every flight we have identified occurred after national airspace reopened. Second, we found no evidence of political intervention. We found no evidence that anyone at the White House above the level of Richard Clark participated in a discussion on the departure of Saudi nationals. The issue came up in one of the many video teleconferences of the interagency group Clark chaired, and Clark said he approved of how the FBI was dealing with the matter when it came up for interagency discussion at his level. Clark told us, "I asked the FBI, Dale Watson, to handle that, to check to see if that was all right with them, to see if they wanted access to any of these people and to get back to me. And if they had no objections, it would be fine with me." Clark added, "I have no recollection of clearing it with anybody at the White House." Although White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card remembered someone telling him about the Saudi request shortly after 9/11, he said he had not talked to the Saudis and did not ask anyone to do anything about it. The President and Vice President told us they were not aware of the issue at all until it surfaced much later in the media. None of the officials we interviewed recalled any intervention or direction on this matter from any political appointee. Third, we believed that the FBI conducted a satisfactory screening of Saudi nationals who left the United States on charter flights. The Saudi government was advised of and agreed to the FBI's requirements that passengers be identified and checked against various databases before the flights departed. The Federal Aviation Administration representative working in the FBI Operations Center made sure the FBI was aware of the flights of Saudi nationals and was able to screen the passengers before they were allowed to depart. The FBI interviewed all persons of interest on these flights prior to their departures. They concluded that none of the passengers was connected to the 9/11 attacks and have since found no evidence to change that conclusion. Our own independent review of the Saudi nationals involved confirms that no one with known links to terrorism departed on these flights. Section 10.2, Planning for War. By late in the evening of September 11th, the President had addressed the nation on the terrible events of the day. Vice President Cheney described the President's mood as somber. The long day was not yet over. When the larger meeting that included his domestic department heads broke up, President Bush chaired a smaller meeting of top advisors, a group he would later call his War Council. This group usually included Vice President Cheney, Secretary of State Powell, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, General Hugh Shelton, Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, later to become Chairman, General Myers, DCI Tenet, Attorney General Ashcroft, and FBI Director Robert Mueller. From the White House staff, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and Chief of Staff Card were part of the core group, often joined by their deputies Stephen Hadley and Joshua Bolten. In this restricted National Security Council meeting, the president said it was a time for self-defense. The United States would punish not just the perpetrators of the attacks, but also those who harbored them. Secretary Powell said the United States had to make clear to Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the Arab states that the time to act was now. He said he would need to build a coalition. The president noted that the attacks provided a great opportunity to engage Russia and China. Secretary Rumsfeld urged that the president and the principals think broadly about who might have harbored the attackers, including Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Sudan, and Iran. He wondered aloud how much evidence the United States would need in order to deal with these countries, pointing out that a major strike could take up to 60 days to assemble. President Bush chaired two more meetings of the NSC on September 12th. In the first meeting, he stressed that the United States was at war with a new and different kind of enemy. The president asked principals to go beyond their pre-9/11 work and develop a strategy to eliminate terrorists and punish those who support them. As they worked on defining the goals and objectives of the upcoming campaign, they considered a paper that went beyond Al-Qaeda to propose the elimination of terrorism as a threat to our way of life, an aim that would include pursuing other international terrorist organizations in the Middle East. Rice chaired a principals' committee meeting on September 11th in the Situation Room to refine how the fight against Al-Qaeda would be conducted. The principals agreed that the overall message should be that anyone supporting Al-Qaeda would risk harm. The United States would need to integrate diplomacy, financial measures, intelligence, and military actions in an overarching strategy. The principals also focused on Pakistan and what it could do to turn the Taliban against Al-Qaeda. They concluded that if Pakistan decided not to help the United States, it too would be at risk. The same day, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage met with the Pakistani ambassador to the United States, Malia Lodi, and the visiting head of Pakistan's military intelligence service, Mahmoud Ahmed. Armitage said that the United States wanted Pakistan to take seven steps. 1. To stop Al-Qaeda operatives at its border and end all logistical support for bin Laden. 2. To give the United States blanket overflight and landing rights for all necessary military and intelligence operations. 3. To provide territorial access to U.S. and allied military intelligence and other personnel to conduct operations against Al-Qaeda. 4. To provide the United States with intelligence information. 5. To continue to publicly condemn the terrorist acts. 6. To cut off all shipments of fuel to the Taliban and stop recruits from going to Afghanistan. And 7. If the evidence implicated bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban continued to harbor them, to break relations with the Taliban government. Pakistan made its decision swiftly. That afternoon, Secretary of State Powell announced at the beginning of an NSC meeting that Pakistani President Musharraf had agreed to every U.S. request for support in the war on terrorism. The next day, the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad confirmed that Musharraf and his top military commanders had agreed to all seven demands. Pakistan will need full U.S. support as it proceeds with us, the embassy noted. Musharraf said the GOP, Government of Pakistan, was making substantial concessions in allowing use of its territory, and he would pay a domestic price. His standing in Pakistan was certain to suffer. To counterbalance that, he needed to show that Pakistan was benefiting from his decisions. At the September 13th NSC meeting, when Secretary Powell described Pakistan's reply, President Bush led a discussion of an appropriate ultimatum to the Taliban. He also ordered Secretary Rumsfeld to develop a military plan against the Taliban. The president wanted the United States to strike the Taliban, step back, wait to see if they got the message, and hit them hard if they did not. He made it clear that the military should focus on targets that would influence the Taliban's behavior. President Bush also tasked the State Department, on which the following day delivered to the White House a paper titled Game Plan for a Political Military Strategy for Pakistan and Afghanistan. The paper took it as a given that bin Laden would continue to act against the United States, even while under Taliban control. It therefore detailed specific U.S. demands for the Taliban: surrender bin Laden and his chief lieutenants, including Ayman al-Zawahiri, tell the United States what the Taliban knew about al-Qaeda and its operations, close all terrorist camps, free all imprisoned foreigners, and comply with all UN Security Council resolutions. The State Department proposed delivering an ultimatum to the Taliban: produce bin Laden and his deputies and shut down al-Qaeda camps within 24 to 48 hours, or the United States will use all necessary means to destroy the terrorist infrastructure. The State Department did not expect the Taliban to comply. Therefore, state and defense would plan to build an international coalition to go into Afghanistan. Both departments would consult with NATO and other allies and request intelligence, basing, and other support from countries according to their capabilities and resources. Finally, the plan detailed a public U.S. stance. America would use all its resources to eliminate terrorism as a threat, punish those responsible for the 9/11 attacks, hold states and other actors responsible for providing sanctuary to terrorists, work with a coalition to eliminate terrorist groups and networks, and avoid malice toward any people, religion, or culture. President Bush recalled that he quickly realized that the administration would have to invade Afghanistan with ground troops, but the early briefings to the President and Secretary Rumsfeld on military options were disappointing. Tommy Franks, the commanding general of Central Command, CENTCOM, told us that the President was dissatisfied. The U.S. military, Franks said, did not have an off-the-shelf plan to eliminate the al-Qaeda threat in Afghanistan. The existing infinite resolve options did not, in his view, amount to such a plan. All these diplomatic and military plans were received over the weekend of September 15th through 16th as President Bush convened his War Council in Camp David. Present were Vice President Cheney, Rice, Hadley, Powell, Armitage, Rumsfeld, Ashcroft, Mueller, Tenet, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, and Colfer Black, Chief of the DCI's Counterterrorist Center. Tenet described a plan for collecting intelligence and mounting covert operations. He proposed inserting CIA teams into Afghanistan to work with Afghan warlords who would join the fight against al-Qaeda. These CIA teams would act jointly with the military's special operations units. President Bush later praised this proposal, saying it had been a turning point in his thinking. General Shelton briefed the principals on the preliminary plan for Afghanistan that the military had put together. It drew on the Infinite Resolve phased campaign plan the Pentagon had been developing in November 2000 as an addition to the strike options it had been refining since 1998. But Shelton added a new element: the possible significant use of ground forces, and that is where President Bush reportedly focused his attention. After hearing from his senior advisors, President Bush discussed with Rice the contents of the directives he would issue to set all the plans into motion. Rice prepared a paper that President Bush then considered with principals on Monday morning, September 17th. The purpose of this meeting, he recalls saying, is to assign tasks for the first wave of the war against terrorism. It starts today. In a written set of instructions slightly refined during the morning meeting, President Bush charged Ashcroft, Mueller, and Tenet to develop a plan for homeland defense. President Bush directed Secretary of State Powell to deliver an ultimatum to the Taliban along the lines that his department had originally proposed. The State Department was also asked to develop a plan to stabilize Pakistan and to be prepared to notify Russia and countries near Afghanistan where hostilities were imminent. In addition, President Bush and his advisors discussed new authorities for covert action in Afghanistan, including the administration's first memorandum of notification on bin Laden. Shortly thereafter, Bush authorized broad new authorities for the CIA. President Bush instructed Rumsfeld and Shelton to develop further the Camp David military plan to attack the Taliban and al-Qaeda if the Taliban rejected the ultimatum. The president also asked Rumsfeld to ensure that robust measures to protect American military forces against terrorist attack were implemented worldwide. Finally, he directed Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill to craft a plan to target al-Qaeda's funding and seize its assets. NSC staff members had begun leading meetings on terrorist fundraising by September 18th. Also, by September 18th, Powell had contacted 58 of his foreign counterparts and received offers of general aid, search and rescue equipment, and personnel and medical assistance teams. On the same day, Deputy Secretary of State Armitage was called by Mahmoud Ahmed regarding a 2-day visit to Afghanistan, during which the Pakistani intelligence chief had met with Mullah Omar and conveyed the U.S. demands. Omar's response was not negative on all these points, but the administration knew that the Taliban was unlikely to turn over bin Laden. The pre-9/11 draft presidential directive on al-Qaeda evolved into a new directive, National Security Presidential Directive 9, now titled Defeating the Terrorist Threat to the United States. The directive would now extend to a global war on terrorism, not just on al-Qaeda. It also incorporated the president's determination not to distinguish between terrorists and those who harbor them. It included a determination to use military force, if necessary, to end al-Qaeda's sanctuary in Afghanistan. The new directive, formally signed on October 25th after the fighting in Afghanistan had already begun, included new material followed by annexes discussing each targeted terrorist group. The old draft directive on al-Qaeda became, in effect, the first annex. The United States would strive to eliminate all terrorist networks, dry up their financial support, and prevent them from acquiring weapons of mass destruction. The goal was the elimination of terrorism as a threat to our way of life. Section 10.3, Phase 2 and Questions of Iraq. President Bush had wondered immediately after the attack whether Saddam Hussein's regime may have had a hand in it. Iraq had been an enemy of the United States for 11 years and was the only place in the world where the United States was engaged in ongoing combat operations. As a former pilot, the president was struck by the apparent sophistication of the operation and some of the piloting, especially Hanjour's high-speed dive into the Pentagon. He told us he recalled Iraqi support for Palestinian suicide terrorists as well. Speculating about other possible states that could be involved, the president told us he also thought about Iran. Clark has written that on the evening of September 12th, President Bush told him and some of his staff to explore possible Iraqi links to 9/11. "See if Saddam did this," Clark recalls the president telling them. "See if he's linked in any way." While he believed the details of Clark's account to be incorrect, President Bush acknowledged that he might well have spoken to Clark at some point, asking him about Iraq. Responding to the presidential tasking, Clark's office sent a memo to Rice on September 18th titled Survey of Intelligence Information on Any Iraq Involvement in the September 11th Attacks. Rice's chief staffer on Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalizad, concurred in its conclusion that only some anecdotal evidence linked Iraq to al-Qaeda. The memo found no compelling case that Iraq had either planned or perpetrated the attacks. It passed along a few foreign intelligence reports, including the Czech report alleging an April 2001 Prague meeting between Atta and an Iraqi intelligence officer, discussed in Chapter 7, and a Polish report that personnel at the headquarters of Iraqi intelligence in Baghdad were told before September 11th to go on the streets to gauge crowd reaction to an unspecified event. Arguing that the case for links between Iraq and al-Qaeda was weak, the memo pointed out that bin Laden resented the secularism of Saddam Hussein's regime. Finally, the memo said there was no confirmed reporting on Saddam cooperating with bin Laden on unconventional weapons. On the afternoon of 9/11, according to contemporaneous notes, Secretary Rumsfeld instructed General Myers to obtain quickly as much information as possible. The notes indicate that he also told Myers that he was not simply interested in striking empty training sites. He thought the U.S. response should consider a wide range of options and possibilities. The secretary said his instinct was to hit Saddam Hussein at the same time, not only bin Laden. Secretary Rumsfeld later explained that at the time he had been considering either one of them or perhaps someone else as the responsible party. According to Rice, the issue of what, if anything, to do about Iraq was really engaged at Camp David. Briefing papers on Iraq, along with many others, were in briefing materials for the participants. Rice told us the administration was concerned that Iraq would take advantage of the 9/11 attacks. She recalled that in the first Camp David session shared by the president, Rumsfeld asked what the administration should do about Iraq. Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz made the case for striking Iraq during this round of the war on terrorism. A Defense Department paper for the Camp David briefing book on the strategic concept for the war on terrorism specified three priority targets for initial action: Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and Iraq. It argued that of the three, Al-Qaeda and Iraq posed a strategic threat to the United States. Iraq's long-standing involvement in terrorism was cited, along with its interest in weapons of mass destruction. Powell recalled that Wolfowitz, not Rumsfeld, argued that Iraq was ultimately the source of the terrorist problem and should therefore be attacked. Secretary Powell said that Wolfowitz was not able to justify his belief that Iraq was behind 9/11. Paul was always of the view that Iraq was a problem that had to be dealt with, Powell told us, and he saw this as one way of using this event as a way to deal with the Iraq problem. Powell said that President Bush did not give Wolfowitz's argument much weight. Though continuing to worry about Iraq in the following week, Powell said, President Bush saw Afghanistan as the priority. President Bush told Bob Woodward that the decision not to invade Iraq was made at the morning session on September 15th. Iraq was not even on the table during the September 15th afternoon session, which dealt solely with Afghanistan. Rice said that when President Bush called her on Sunday, September 16th, he said the focus would be on Afghanistan, though he still wanted plans for Iraq should the country take some action, or the administration eventually determine that it had been involved in the 9/11 attacks. At the September 17th NSC meeting, there was some further discussion of Phase 2 of the war on terrorism. President Bush ordered the Defense Department to be ready to deal with Iraq if Baghdad acted against U.S. interests, with plans to include possibly occupying Iraqi oil fields. Within the Pentagon, Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz continued to press the case for dealing with Iraq. Writing to Rumsfeld on September 17th in a memo headlined, "Preventing More Events," he argued that if there was even a 10% chance that Saddam Hussein was behind the 9/11 attack, maximum priority should be placed on eliminating the threat. Wolfowitz contended that the odds were far more than 1 in 10, citing Saddam's praise for the attack, his long record of involvement in terrorism, and theories that Ramzi Youssef was an Iraqi agent and Iraq was behind the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center. The next day, Wolfowitz renewed the argument, writing to Rumsfeld about the interest of Youssef's co-conspirator in the 1995 Manila air plot in crashing an explosives-laden plane into CIA headquarters, and about information from a foreign government regarding Iraqis' involvement in the attempted hijacking of a Gulf Air flight. Given this background, he wondered why so little thought had been devoted to the danger of suicide plots, seeing a failure of imagination and a mindset that dismissed possibilities. On September 19th, Rumsfeld offered several thoughts for his commanders as they worked on their contingency plans. Though he emphasized the worldwide nature of the conflict, the references to specific enemies or regions named only the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and Afghanistan. Shelton told us the administration reviewed all the Pentagon's war plans and challenged certain assumptions underlying them, as any prudent organization or leader should do. General Tommy Franks, the commanding general of Central Command, recalled receiving Rumsfeld's guidance that each regional commander should assess what these plans meant for his area of responsibility. He knew he would soon be striking the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, but, he told us, he now wondered how that action was connected to what might need to be done in Somalia, Yemen, or Iraq. On September 20th, President Bush met with British Prime Minister Tony Blair, and the two leaders discussed the global conflict ahead. When Blair asked about Iraq, the president replied that Iraq was not an immediate problem. Some members of his administration, he commented, had expressed a different view, but he was the one responsible for making the decisions. Franks told us he was pushing independently to do more robust planning on military responses in Iraq during the summer before 9/11, a request President Bush denied, arguing that the time was not right. CENTCOM also began dusting off plans for a full invasion of Iraq during this period, Franks said. The CENTCOM commander told us he renewed his appeal for further military planning to respond to Iraqi moves shortly after 9/11, both because he personally felt that Iraq and Al-Qaeda might be engaged in some form of collusion, and because he worried that Saddam might take advantage of the attacks to move against his internal enemies in the northern and southern parts of Iraq, where the U.S. was flying regular missions to enforce Iraqi no-fly zones. Frank said that President Bush again turned down the request. Having issued directives to guide his administration's preparations for war, on Thursday, September 20th, President Bush addressed the nation before a joint session of Congress. "Tonight," he said, "we are a country awakened to danger." The president blamed al-Qaeda for 9/11 and the 1998 embassy bombings, and for the first time declared that al-Qaeda was responsible for bombing the USS Cole. He reiterated the ultimatum that had already been privately conveyed. "The Taliban must act and act immediately," he said. "They will hand over the terrorists or they will share in their fate." The president added that America's quarrel was not with Islam. "The enemy of America is not our many Muslim friends. It is not our many Arab friends. Our enemy is a radical network of terrorists and every government that supports them." Other regimes faced hard choices, he pointed out. "Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you're with us or you're with the terrorists." President Bush argued that the new war went beyond bin Laden. "Our war on terror begins with al-Qaeda, but it does not end there," he said. "It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated." The president had a message for the Pentagon. "The hour is coming when America will act and you will make us proud." He also had a message for those outside the United States. "This is civilization's fight," he said. "We ask every nation to join us." President Bush approved military plans to attack Afghanistan in meetings with Central Command's General Franks and other advisors on September 21st and October 2nd. Originally titled Infinite Justice, the operation's code word was changed to avoid the sensibilities of Muslims who associate the power of infinite justice with God alone to the operational name still used for operations in Afghanistan, Enduring Freedom. The plan had four phases. In Phase 1, the United States and its allies would move forces into the region and arrange to operate from or over neighboring countries such as Uzbekistan and Pakistan. This occurred in the weeks following 9/11, aided by overwhelming international sympathy for the United States. In Phase 2, airstrikes and special operations attacks would hit key al-Qaeda and Taliban targets. In an innovative joint effort, CIA and special operations forces would be deployed to work together, with each major Afghan faction opposed to the Taliban. The Phase 2 strikes and raids began on October 7th. The basing arrangements contemplated for Phase 1 were substantially secured after arduous effort by the end of that month. In Phase 3, the United States would carry out decisive operations using all elements of national power, including ground troops, to topple the Taliban regime and eliminate al-Qaeda's sanctuary in Afghanistan. Mazar-e-Sharif in northern Afghanistan fell to a coalition assault by Afghan and U.S. forces on November 9th. 4 days later, the Taliban had fled from Kabul. By early December, all major cities had fallen to the coalition. On December 22nd, Hamid Karzai, a Pashtun leader from Kandahar, was installed as the chairman of Afghan's interim administration. Afghanistan had been liberated from the rule of the Taliban. In December 2001, Afghan forces with limited U.S. support engaged al-Qaeda elements in a cave complex called Tora Bora. In March 2002, the largest engagement of the war was fought in the mountainous Shah Aqut area south of Gardez against a large force of al-Qaeda jihadists. The three-week battle was substantially successful, and almost all remaining al-Qaeda forces took refuge in Pakistan's equally mountainous and lightly governed frontier provinces. As of July 2004, bin Laden and Zawahiri are still believed to be at large. In Phase 4, civilian and military operations turned to the indefinite task of what the armed forces called security and stability operations. Within about 2 months of the start of combat operations, several hundred CIA operatives and special forces soldiers, backed by the striking power of U.S. aircraft and a much larger infrastructure of intelligence and support efforts, had combined with Afghan militias and a small number of other coalition soldiers to destroy the Taliban regime and disrupt al-Qaeda. They had killed or captured about a quarter of the enemy's known leaders. Mohammad Atef, al-Qaeda's military commander and a principal figure in the 9/11 plot, had been killed by a U.S. airstrike. According to a senior CIA officer who helped devise the overall strategy, the CIA provided intelligence, experience, cash, covert action capabilities, and entree to tribal allies. In turn, the U.S. military offered combat expertise, firepower, logistics, and communications. With these initial victories won by the middle of 2002, the global conflict against Islamist terrorism became a different kind of struggle. Chapter 11, Foresight and Hindsight. In composing this narrative, we've tried to remember that we write with the benefit and the handicap of hindsight. Hindsight can sometimes see the past clearly with 20/20 vision, but the path of what happened is so brightly lit that it places everything else more deeply into shadow. Commenting on Pearl Harbor, Roberta Wallstetter found it much easier after the event to sort the relevant from the irrelevant signals. After the event, of course, the signal is always crystal clear. We can now see what disaster it was signaling since the disaster has occurred. But before the event, it is obscure and pregnant with conflicting meanings. As time passes, more documents become available, and the bare facts of what happened become still clearer. Yet the picture of how those things happened becomes harder to reimagine as that past world, with its preoccupations and uncertainty, recedes, and the remaining memories of it become colored by what happened and what was written about it later. With that caution in mind, we asked ourselves, before we judged others, whether the insights that seem apparent now would really have been meaningful at the time, given the limits of what people then could reasonably have known or done. We believe the 9/11 attacks revealed four kinds of failures in imagination, policy, capabilities, and management. Section 11.1, Imagination. Historical perspective. The 9/11 attack was an event of surpassing disproportion. America had suffered surprise attacks before. Pearl Harbor is one well-known case, the 1950 Chinese attack in Korea another. But these were attacks by major powers. While by no means as threatening as Japan's act of war, the 9/11 attack was in some ways more devastating. It was carried out by a tiny group of people, not enough to man a full platoon. Measured on a governmental scale, the resources behind it were trivial. The group itself was dispatched by an organization based in one of the poorest, most remote, and least industrialized countries on Earth. This organization recruited a mixture of young fanatics and highly educated zealots who could not find suitable places in their home societies or were driven from them. To understand these events, we attempted to reconstruct some of the context of the 1990s. Americans celebrated the end of the Cold War with a mixture of relief and satisfaction. The people of the United States hoped to enjoy a peace dividend as U.S. spending on national security was cut following the end of the Soviet military threat. The United States emerged into the post-Cold World War as the world's preeminent military power. But the vacuum created by the sudden demise of the Soviet Union created fresh sources of instability and new challenges for the United States. President George H.W. Bush dealt with the first of these in 1990 and 1991, when he led an international coalition to reverse Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. Other examples of U.S. leaders handling new threats included the removal of nuclear weapons from Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan, the Nunn-Lugar Threat Reduction Program to help contain new nuclear dangers, and international involvement in the wars in Bosnia and Kosovo. America stood out as an object for admiration, envy, and blame. This created a kind of cultural asymmetry. To us, Afghanistan seemed very far away. To members of Al-Qaeda, America seemed very close. In a sense, they were more globalized than we were. Understanding the danger. If the government's leaders understood the gravity of the threat they faced and understood at the same time that their policies to eliminate it were not likely to succeed anytime soon, then history's judgment will be harsh. Did they understand the gravity of the threat? The U.S. government responded vigorously when the attack was on our soil. Both Ramzi Youssef, who organized the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, and Mir Amal Khansi, who in 1993 killed two CIA employees as they waited to go to work in Langley, Virginia, were the objects of relentless, uncompromising, and successful efforts to bring them back to the United States to stand trial for their crimes. Before 9/11, Al-Qaeda and its affiliates had killed fewer than 50 Americans, including the East Africa embassy bombings and the coal attack. The U.S. government took the threat seriously, but not in the sense of mustering anything like the kind of effort that would be gathered to confront an enemy of the first, second, or even third rank. the modest national effort exerted to contain Serbia and its depredations in the Balkans between 1995 and 1999, for example, was orders of magnitude larger than that devoted to Al-Qaeda. As best we can determine, neither in 2000 nor in the first 8 months of 2001 did any polling organization in the United States think the subject of terrorism sufficiently on the minds of the public to warrant asking a question about it in a major national survey. Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, or even terrorism was not an important topic in the 2000 presidential campaign. Congress and the media called little attention to it. If a president wanted to rally the American people to a warlike effort, he would need to publicize an assessment of the growing Al-Qaeda danger. Our government could spark a full public discussion of who Osama